What I thought we would do for this final session is that I would present for a shorter period of time, and that would allow plenty of time if needed for questions that you might have. And depending on how many of those, you know, we can go on our homeward way rejoicing earlier rather than later. But what we'll want to do in this session is partly to review some of the points that we've already looked at, and then build on some of the basic elements that we've already looked at. So, as I said, this might not take too long, but I hope it will reiterate some of the basic points that I'd like to emphasize. Now, I hope that one of the things that we've seen in Genesis 1 to 11 is that the book is concerned very much with the so what question. What is the significance of believing in God? What's the significance of believing in a creator? And although it is interested in the how and the what, I think it's more interested in the so what. What is the significance? And if we look at Genesis 1 to 11 as a whole, then we can consider a number of themes which we could say hold Genesis 1 to 11 together. Common themes which run throughout it. Now, I've chosen one of those themes because I think this one theme does encapsulate, perhaps better than almost any other, what the thrust of Genesis 1 to 11 is all about. And the theme I'd like us to remind ourselves of, but also build on, is this theme of chaos and order, and how God brings order out of chaos. So to begin that, let's just remind ourselves of one or two things we've already seen. This shouldn't be new if you've been alert during the rest of the day. So if we go to the creation account and just review its structure. Remember, we looked at this last night. We've seen it once or twice since. We have a basic grid of creation which begins with chaos, begins with tohu wa bohu, and then in an orderly, balanced and structured fashion with days balancing and referring to one another, we end up from chaos, through order, to rest on the Sabbath day at the end. And we say, well, what might this tell us about God? If this is how God works, then what kind of a God is he? And some obvious statements to make in answer to that question would be that God is a God of order. He works decently and in order. He's a God with a purpose. He's moving towards his goal in an ordered fashion, not haphazardly, just sort of thrashing around, as it were. You don't get the idea that God wakes up on the fourth day saying, now, I wonder, what shall I do next? You know, it is ordered, coherent, and he works in that manner. And there's that obvious movement from chaos to order. So in the beginning, God brought physical order, physical harmony, out of physical chaos. Once that is established, however, we see a ringing of the changes on this idea of order and chaos. And so whereas here in Genesis 1, we've got physical chaos resulting in physical order, we now have an interest in Genesis, not simply with physical chaos and physical order, but with moral and spiritual chaos and moral and spiritual order. So let me just take you through some basic elements of what I mean when I talk about a movement from moral and spiritual order to moral and spiritual chaos. In Genesis 3, verse 12, you remember God comes and he asks the man what he's done, and the man's answer, well, you can read it at one level and it's perfectly correct. You know, he says, the man said, the woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me fruit from the tree and I ate. Well, at one level, you know, that's just straightforward. But what about the tone of voice? How do you think the man, Adam, might have said that? I rather think he spoke like this, the woman. I've met some men who refer to their wives as the woman. I've often wondered about the depth of their commitment. He could have said, my wife, but he didn't. The woman. Remember what he said the first time he saw her? At last, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. You can almost see the tears coming down the fellow's cheeks, can't you? We're almost embarrassed to listen and look in because this seems such a personal and intimate moment. But now she is the woman. The woman you gave me. He blames his wife and he blames God. There's only one innocent person in this, and this is Adam himself. That's the tone of voice which I think we have here. The woman whom you gave to be with me. If you hadn't done that, we wouldn't be in this mess. Well, this is a kind of a living translation, but that's the implication of what he says. That's in Genesis 3. Then we move on into Genesis 4. Remember, Cain and Abel have this dispute, and when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Now you see, the man, Adam, he blames his wife, and he blames God. But he blames his wife. But Cain kills his brother. We've gone a step further in moral and spiritual chaos. And Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and he settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. The land of Nod. Now, where might the land of Nod be? I don't really think it is a geographical location, because the word Nod comes from a Hebrew verb which means to wander aimlessly. Cain kills his brother, he accuses God, and he ends up in the land of Nod, of aimless wandering, a land of moral and spiritual chaos. Then in Genesis 4, Lamech said to his wives, you notice the plural, Lamech said to his wives, now you notice what the man in the garden said about his wife, the woman. How does Lamech address his dearly beloveds? Ada and Zillah, hear my voice. So we know who wears the trousers in this house, right? Ada and Zillah, hear my voice. You wives of Lamech, listen to what I say. I've killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 77-fold. In other words, if you think Cain is bad, you ain't seen nothing yet. Lamech is projecting himself in terms of sinful rebellion beyond that of Cain. And then, of course, we get that summary statement. Some of us were talking about this over the meal. In Genesis 6, verse 5, the Lord saw that the wickedness of humankind was great in the earth, that every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. And so, you see, step by step, we're moving closer and closer to a kind of an utter moral and spiritual chaos until just before the flood, every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. And God's response to that, God's response to the moral and spiritual chaos in the world, is to turn the world into physical chaos at the time of the flood. Remember, we saw how the flood is a reversion of creation. So the moral and spiritual chaos in humanity produces physical chaos in the world. And then we get, remember, the flood story, beginning with physical order, moving down to physical chaos in the middle. In the middle, God remembers Noah. God remembers Noah at the time when the entire earth is covered in water. It's reverted back to tohu wa bohu, Actually, I haven't asked you to repeat that. I usually ask people to do that. Tohu wa vohu. Can you say that? You never know when you might need to say that. All right. So, but it's got that sense of, well, tohu and vohu, you know, it's total physical chaos. And then once we reach that point, we move back to order again. So this movement from physical order to physical chaos, from physical chaos back to physical order, is occasioned by the descent of humanity into moral and spiritual chaos. In the middle of that chaos, God remembers Noah. God saves Noah. God acts on his behalf. So the God who judges, because the flood is a judgment, but the God who judges is also the God who saves. It's one and the same God. But we also saw this, remember, that we have sin immediately before the flood. That's the incident of the sons of God and the daughters of men, the judgment on offenders and grace to Noah. That's a reference to the sons of God and the daughters of men, whatever that incident might refer to, immediately before the flood. And then we get the offense immediately after the flood. So remember what we said is that the flood did nothing to solve the problem of sin. Sin immediately before, sin immediately after. So it judges sinners, but it doesn't solve the problem of sin. For that, we need, well, ultimately, of course, scripturally, we need the death and resurrection of Christ. Now, as we come towards the end of the primeval history, as we enter chapter 11, we come to the story of the Tower of Babel. I just want to read a couple of verses, two or three verses, from Babel. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves. Otherwise we shall be scattered abroad upon the face of all the whole earth." So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. So the people here refuse God's way. What exactly is the sin of the people of Babel? Well, there's more than one view on this, as on most things, but I think one of the most compelling suggestions is this. What is their motivation? They say, "Let's build the city. Let's make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we shall be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth." Now, in creation, when God first speaks to humanity, he says, "Be fruitful and multiply," and they don't want to fill the earth. They're quite happy where they are. "We'll stay right here. We're not going to fill the earth. We're not going to do that." But more important than that, God calls it Babel. What does Babel mean? Confusion, yes, or to use a term we've been using already, it's chaos. It's the story of the Tower of Chaos, but it's moral and spiritual chaos. Moral and spiritual confusion here at the Tower of Babel. So when we see that Babel, confusion, chaos, concludes the primeval history, it concludes the narrative of Genesis 1 to 11, and then we stand back from Genesis 1 to 11 and take in the whole spread of those 11 chapters, what we then see is this, I hope, with apologies for this graphic, which could be better, but anyway. In the beginning, in Genesis 1, We have tohu and bohu, chaos at creation. That chaos, however, is physical chaos. Chapter 11, the end of the primeval history, we have Babel, which is chaos, moral and spiritual chaos. So the story of Genesis 1 to 11 is a story of chaos from beginning to end. Except it begins with physical chaos and it ends with moral and spiritual chaos. Now, when God was confronted with physical chaos at the beginning, how did God move physical chaos to physical order? Well, remember we said that one of the main characteristics of the creation account is that God's creation is effortless. So how does he get things going from physical chaos to physical order? And God said, let there be light. And there was light. So it goes on. But how is God going to get the world to move from moral and spiritual chaos? Will that require more than just a be nice to one another? Or a divine command to do something? It's going to be a much harder task to turn the world from moral and spiritual chaos to moral and spiritual order than it is to get inanimate matter from chaos to order. So, on that note as well, on the Tower of Babel, let's look at an aspect which is related to that, which is God's acts of grace in Genesis 1 to 11. And the major acts of God's grace in Genesis 1 to 11 would be these. To Adam and Eve, remember God said, on the day you eat of it, you shall surely die. But they do not die immediately, and God clothes them. So that's God's act of grace to Adam and Eve. Cain, well, Cain receives a mark to protect him. Now, one of the strange things about the interpretation of the Bible is that something positive can be turned into something negative. It's quite clear in the Bible that the mark on Cain is to protect him. It's an act of grace. It isn't a curse, as was, you know, perpetrated by many concerning, you know, the black race is accursed with the mark of Cain. Nothing at all. Cain receives a mark to protect him. It's an act of grace. Then at the flood, well, God remembers Noah. Noah found, what did he find? Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. But at Babel, it's no act of grace. They're simply scattered abroad on the face of all the earth. So when does grace turn up then? Let me ask you that question. There's no grace at Babel. There's no grace shown to all the nations of the earth in their rebellion against God at Babel. So where does grace appear in the story? The story of Abraham. Remember what the story of Abraham says? Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I'll make of you a great nation. And through you, all nations of the earth will be blessed. Which nations of the earth? Well, the nations of the earth that have just been sent packing from Babel. Those very same families of the earth will be blessed. So the grace shown to Abraham is an answer to the problem of Babel, but it's an act of grace to the entire world, which culminates in the ministry of Jesus and so on. So let's compare, and we'll just spend a little bit of time on this. If we compare the call of Abraham with the chaos at Babel. Now the Lord said to Abram, I'll go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I'll make of you a great nation. I'll bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So with the call of Abraham, you notice, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. At Babel, now the whole earth had one language. They then say, otherwise we shall be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth. So the extent of God's grace to Abraham, all the families of the earth, embraces the extent of the problem of Babel, which was all the earth. And to Abram, God said, I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great. That statement of God to Abram, I will make your name great, does that recall anything that we read in the story of Babel? Any detail there that you can think of? That's right, yes. Let us make a name for ourselves. So the people at Babel want to make a name for ourselves, but God says to Abram, I will make your name great. So it's the contrast between human ambition and human works at Babel and divine grace with Abram. Okay, so I think, okay. So, Genesis 1 to 11 is a story of chaos and order. It's repeated, well, we find it in the creation story, we find it in the flood story, we find it in the Babel story. We find it as a thread running throughout on the moral and spiritual chaos of humanity. Genesis 1 to 11 is concerned with this dynamic of order and chaos. And though Genesis 1 to 11 deals with matters of ultimate significance, I would say. Now, let me just make one or two general conclusions just to round off this and the weekend. When we read Genesis 1 to 11, if we ask the so what questions, what does Genesis 1 to 11 affirm when we ask that question, so what? What's it all about? Well, first of all, it tells us that we don't live in a meaningless universe. The universe is not meaningless. Life does have meaning. And that meaning is tied up with God, the Creator. Just as God brought order out of chaos at the beginning, He can bring order to the chaos of our lives. Because I think all of us at some stage have felt or do feel that our lives simply are chaotic. And perhaps more than anything else, I think, when we look at the accounts of creation and so on in Genesis 1 to 11. Genesis 1 to 11 are concerned to tell us that this world had a meaningful beginning. If this world had a meaningful beginning, it means it can have a meaningful end. If the world had no meaningful beginning, it cannot have a meaningful end. And if this world had neither a meaningful beginning nor a meaningful end, it means that our lives are meaningless. But if you think about our denominational name, Seventh-day Adventist. Seventh day, remind you of Sabbath, which is a reminder of creation, which is God's meaningful beginning. Adventist, remind you of Second Coming, which is God's redemption and God's meaningful end. Seventh day, meaningful beginning. Adventist, meaningful end. Now the problem with concentrating just on those two is that if we're always thinking about God's meaningful beginning, then we're looking behind us to the past. And if we're just looking at God's meaningful end, we're looking forward to what's coming. I think we should never forget that if this world did have a meaningful beginning, and it does have a meaningful end, then our lives have meaning in the present. And that the doctrine of creation and the accounts of creation are to give us not simply knowledge of the past, nor simply hope for the future, but meaning in the present. Because if our faith doesn't impact on our lives right now, I don't think we've understood the significance of creation, nor significance of the Second Coming. Okay. We have time for a few questions, if you would like. If you don't like, then that's all right. There's no pressure. So if you have any questions on maybe what we've done this evening, or any time during the weekend, there seems to be no real enthusiasm. Oh, there is a question. Yes.
You haven't actually covered this topic, but with the genealogies, both up to Noah and then up to Christ's time, and the ages of the people between the generations, we use these figures to determine approximately how old the earth is since creation. Mm-hmm. But some say that there are some gaps in the genealogies. Mm-hmm. What is your thoughts on this?
Well, it does depend really on the on which genealogies you're looking at. So if you look at Matthew's genealogy, for example, we know for a fact that he's missed out some generations, because we can compare his genealogy with that in the Old Testament. So his genealogy does miss things out. Now, what some people would say is you go to the major genealogy, really for the purposes that you've referred to, is that in Genesis 5, which is the genealogy from creation to the flood. That's the kind of critical one. And some people would say, well, that genealogy has generations omitted, so you can work out a chronology based on that genealogy, but with numerous generations missing, it could be much, much longer. Now, just strictly reading the text, you cannot allow for missed generations in the genealogy of Genesis 5, because each generation is dovetailed into the next one. So, and without mentioning individual names, we're just sort of showing how the thing works. If you say, now, when A had lived, I'll use round figures, when A had lived 100 years, he was the father of B. And after the birth of B, A lived 200 years, thus all the years of A were 300 years, and then he died. I'm not using actual figures, but I'm just illustrating it. And then after B had lived 200 years, he became the father of C. And after the birth of C, B lived another 500 years. Thus all the days of B were 800 years. Now, the problem is, with that kind of a genealogy, there's no room for missing generations, because each generation is dovetailed into the next one with the age at which the father, how old the father is when his firstborn son comes along, and then his years after that firstborn son. So you cannot fit in extra generations. The question, then, the larger question then is, well, what function does this genealogy, what does it set out to be? Does it set out to be information that enables us to make that kind of calculation, or does it have other fish to fry, as it were? You know, does it serve other purposes? But in terms of, can you hypothesize missing generations in the genealogy of Genesis 5? No, you can't. It doesn't work. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm curious about the history. Assuming that Moses wrote Genesis, and he was educated in Egypt, an intelligent, educated young man, did he speak Hebrew in Egypt as one of the slaves in Egypt? And did he write this in Hebrew? If not, where did the Hebrew language come from? And prehistory, pre this, we don't know much about it from any other records. We've only got Genesis, which we assume was written by Moses. Now, when these folk came out of Egypt, we assume they were fairly uneducated. Would they understand all this that we've been talking about today? I'm not doubting it all. I'm just curious about what it was like to be alive then and hear all this. They might have, if they really were cultured Hebrews, they would have understood all these nuances that you've been talking about today, which we don't because we're in a Western society. What would it have been like for those people hearing this? Would they have seen what you've told us today?
Oh, undoubtedly, I'm sure. Well, it's a very difficult question to answer because you're trying to conceptualize something that, you know, I wasn't there, none of us were there. If I take the first part of your question, which was, would they understand everything that is going on? I think the account in the Bible makes it clear that many of them had a problem understanding what was going on. That's why they spent 40 years in the wilderness. If they understood what was going on, I mean, they wouldn't be wanting to go back to Egypt for the sake of onions and garlic, for example. You know, they would have seen the bigger picture, but they didn't. Now, the other question about whether they would understand the intent of the book of Genesis, was that your question? Would they understand that? Well, I can only give a kind of a general answer, I think. I can only assume that they would have understood it in many ways better than we would, because most people encountered literature at that time, not through picking up a book, picking up a scroll and reading it, but they would hear it. So they're an oral culture. And there's plenty of evidence of in the modern world of cultures which are largely oral and yet can have very sophisticated understandings of literature, but it's oral literature, it's not written literature. So as they hear it, and well, for example, you know, we looked at the way in which the flood story is put together, you know, the second half, a mirror image of the first half. If you are recounting that orally, and you know it's got that structure, then it's an aid to memory. You can present it because you've got an idea in your head of what comes next. And as people hear, they will see those kinds of structures, not as we see them visually on a page, but they will hear them. Why? Because they are attuned orally in a way which we are not. And, you know, sometimes we say, well, I just cannot believe that somebody would ever be able to remember that much. Well, people do in oral cultures. So I can only assume, yes, they would understand it as well, and probably better.
And they did speak Hebrew. Where did it come from?
Well, where does it come from? Well, it's part of the Northwest Semitic family of languages, which includes, the Semitic family of languages would include Egyptian, and so it's related to those languages. So you have other languages. The earliest alphabetic writing we have dates from about the middle of the second millennium and dates to the very area where these Semitic languages were spoken in the Sinai Peninsula. So that's among the first. But of course, there are other Semitic languages like Akkadian, Ugaritic, and so on, which are related to Hebrew. So they're all part of the same kind of family. Exactly how one language develops from another, you know, is debated. But the Bible's written in Hebrew so people can understand it because they speak Hebrew. There was a professor of Hebrew at Oxford University back in the 19th century, who when he taught Hebrew would come into the lecture room and say to all of his theology students, he would say, gentlemen, they were all gentlemen in those days, he says, gentlemen, this is the language God speaks. Well, you see, if you're beginning to learn Hebrew, that puts the fear of God into you to begin with, you see. Now, does God speak Hebrew? What language is used in the heavenly above? A celestial language, I expect. I don't know.
A couple of questions. First of all, the simple one. I notice when you're reading, you know, in Genesis 4, we're not given the age of Cain and Abel when the awful deed was done.
No.
But we have found in verse 25 of chapter 4, Adam had relations with his wife again, and she gave birth to a son and named him Seth. For she said, verse 26, and to Seth, to him also a son was born, in place of Abel. That's verse 25, sorry. Then we come down to chapter 5, verse 3. It says there, when Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness, according to his image, and named him Seth. It seems to me an awful, inordinate length of time in between children being born when God had told Adam and Eve in very good working order to get on and populate the earth.
Yes.
But why are we seeing these hundreds of years in between what seems to be children being born? I mean, at that rate, the earth wouldn't have been anywhere near occupied for thousands and thousands of years.
I've never actually sort of, I've never heard the question expressed that way before. It's a good question. I'm not sure I know, because let me tell you something related, which is only partly relevant. It gives me time to think, anyway. Which is that of all the commandments that God ever gave to humanity, there's only one commandment that human beings have never had any difficulty fulfilling. Be fruitful and multiply. In fact, you may think that we should say that, you know, could we all ease up a bit, you know. The short answer is I don't know. I mean, it's there, but the reasons for it, you know, are not divulged in the text, so we can only speculate. It's an interesting observation, but as far as an answer goes, I don't have one at the moment.
Kind of linked to that. I seem to have lost it. Oh, there we go. Kind of linked to that, Cain with, you know, the punishment, saying it's too great to bear. There will be that. Whoever finds me will kill me when I wander the earth. So again, that implies that there must have been other people around in order for him to say that.
Yes.
But Cain and Abel were, you know, the first children of Adam and Eve.
Yes. And I used to have an answer to that, but your question on chapter 5 has sort of pulled the rug from under my feet, I think. Because we have Seth born then when Adam's 130. Yeah.
It almost implies that there are more children in between that we're just not told about.
Yeah, it does imply that, certainly. Yeah. Yes, as you read it, it certainly implies that. So do we say, well, all we have here are those that are important to mention? Because when we come on to the other genealogies, we don't get all the children, we just get the firstborn son. But obviously there are other sons and other daughters, for example. But then they're never mentioned in the genealogy. Now, it seems to assume that. I mean, what I used to think, you know, is that we're not given any kind of chronology in chapter 4, and so we don't know how long it's been going on, and therefore how many people may have, you know, by the time Cain kills Abel, if Adam and Eve have had other children, you know, we could have had a group. But I agree that it seems to read as if there are others there, and that's not easily dismissed by saying, you know, if only you understood Hebrew, you know. No, it seems to assume that, I must admit, yeah.
Okay. The other question I wanted to ask, I've noticed in conversation and just generally, there seems to be creeping in to folks' expression that the 6 days of creation, in fact, are not literal days.
Mm-hmm.
Science seems to show other evidence. My own thoughts on that are, you know, God wrote the Ten Commandments in stone with his own finger, and he said, in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth. Mm-hmm. So if that was the case, surely that is making God out to be a liar. But is there any weakening that we could say would allow for anything other than 6 literal days in the creation?
Well, the issues involved are somewhat, in some ways simple and in some ways complicated. In simple terms, when you read Genesis 1 and it talks about there was evening and morning of first day, second day, third day, and so on. The use of the Hebrew word there for day, yom, when it's used with an ordinal number, you know, first, second, or whatever. Everywhere else in the Old Testament where the word day is used with an ordinal number, putting Genesis 1 to one side, but looking at all the other uses of first day, 10th day, 40th, 13th day, it always means a period of 24 hours. Now, of course, there may be some exceptions. Well, no, with ordinal numbers, that's true, yes. So, sorry, let me just clarify in case I misled you. If it's talking about the 4th or 10th or 15th day, it's always 24 hours. You can talk about a period of, you know, 40 days. 40 days is just a Hebrew idiom for a longer period of time. It doesn't mean it has to be literally 40 days. And 3 days is the Hebrew idiom for a shorter period of time, but it doesn't necessarily mean it has to be literally 3 days. So 40 days, long period, 3 days, short period. But when it's an ordinal number, first, ninth, 13th, it's always a period of 24 hours. So you could argue that that's the language of Genesis 1, and because everywhere else it's a period of 24 hours, then it must mean a period of 24 hours in Genesis. And that's, you know, that's a reasonable argument. The larger question, which is exercising some, is somewhat broader than that, which is, what kind of literature is Genesis 1? Is it a chronicle, or is it, by chronicle we mean a literalistic kind of presentation, or is it more imaginative? And in some circles, the jury, you know, is out as to what kind of literature Genesis 1 is. But the use of the term that we talk about, ordinal number with day, that's a reasonable argument for saying that we're dealing with periods of 24 hours. I mean, to take that position is a you're not being you're not making undue demands of the text by saying that. So, first, second, third, fourth day, everywhere else is 24 hours. So, the case, what I would say is that the case for interpreting it other than 24 hours rests with those who wish to show otherwise. So, being open to ongoing revelation, should others show that, well, that's a different matter. But the onus of proof is not on those who want to say that second day means second period of 24 hours. Okay.
You may be touched on it, but I've been hearing some of this. The 11 degree tilt of the earth, is that related to the flood?
Well, if it is, it's not mentioned in the Bible. Now, there's a great deal of thought which has grown up around the flood. And people talk about the biblical account of the flood, you know, which talks about the earth shifting on its axis, continental drift, volcanoes, all this. The Bible has nothing to say about that. All it talks about is a flood. There was an awful lot of water. Nothing more. So it isn't that it isn't related to it. It's just that the Bible is silent on it. Okay.
You said last night that Genesis 1 spoke to the culture of the time. Its agenda was to make statements that related to that particular culture.
Yes.
And what it said had to do with the ultimate questions of life. Can Genesis 1 speak to our culture today? And what might its relevancy be in today's culture? That's the one question.
Right.
The other question
is... Can I answer that one first?
Absolutely.
So don't forget
sure.
it. Sure. The... There's always a danger of being misunderstood when one answers a question like that. So don't misunderstand me. So I'll do my best not to be misunderstood. But it's important to realize that when Genesis was written, the big problem that Genesis was addressing was not evolution. It wasn't addressing that issue because it wasn't in existence. What it was addressing was the problem of polytheism, because that was everywhere. So it's a text addressing creation when the big problem is polytheism. Now that is not our problem. Well, it is in some parts of the world perhaps, but it's not universally the problem. So you could say that where the problem is still polytheism, then Genesis is one for one almost correspondence. But in Scotland, there probably are polytheists in Scotland, but it's not, you know, it's not the major worldview of Scots. So, maybe, is that an answer to your question, or was there's more to it than that, was there? My short-term memory is getting very bad these days.
Right. So. I just wanted to know, because we do have the issue of evolution, and we, I don't know, instinctively go to Genesis 1, and
yes.
we realize it just doesn't deal with it. What questions does Genesis 1 answer that may be relevant to today's society? That was the first question.
Okay, yes. Well, what it affirms is that there is a God who cares. There's a God who creates. This God is not an impersonal force. It's not a pantheistic influence. It's a personal God who stands outside of creation, who takes control of creation, is responsible for creation. As you continue into the story of Genesis, this is a God we can relate to, who relates to us, who gives our lives meaning. So when God creates humanity, he gives them a vocation and a purpose for living. And, well, you know, many people today seem to lack a sense of purpose for living, but that's the picture of the God in the opening chapters of Genesis. So, well, there's probably more than that, but I think in terms of being relevant to human existence, I mean, that's a reasonable amount to get going on, you know, sure, before you start looking at anything else. So I do think it is relevant. But it's a matter of looking at the general relevance and then what we do, what we need to do is proper theology. Now, I know when I say that, people start to yawn and say, oh, no, theology, I mean, you know, that's the number of angels dancing on the pin of a head of a pin. No. What theology is, what theology does, is to take scripture and relate it to the context in which we are living. Theology is what we do with the Bible. But the Bible doesn't give us just an off-the-peg theology that can be used in exactly the same way in Scotland, Zimbabwe, or New Guinea. It has to be incarnated into the culture of the people that we're dealing with. So true theology is exciting stuff, because you have to know, to do true theology, you need to know more than the Bible. You need to understand culture as well.
Okay. Thank you. And the second part, what Bible passages could we look at and exegete and learn about to enable us to answer some of the contemporary questions, especially questions of evolution and that? If Genesis 1 does not set itself to answer those questions, mm-hmm, not directly in any way,
no,
then what other Bible passages would you recommend would be meaningful to engage with in that conversation?
Well, most biblical passages that deal with creation are different from Genesis 1. Most biblical passages dealing with creation are imbued with a sense of awe. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. Now, I can read that, and I can sometimes feel tears coming to my eyes as I contemplate it. And I think that sometimes we try to be too rationalistic. I think we would do a better job of celebrating God's creatorship rather than trying to prove evolution is wrong. Again, I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not saying that these issues are irrelevant. But I think that if people can see us celebrating the Sabbath, for example, I won't go into all the details of how it happened, but I happened to have lunch with a well-known novelist not that long ago. And we were in this art gallery. And, so she was saying, so Lawrence, what exactly do you do? So I said, I lecture. Yes, but what exactly do you lecture? So I said, I lecture in theology at Newbold College. That's a Seventh-day Adventist institution. I said, pardon, I didn't quite get it. So I said, Seventh-day Adventist. So what exactly is it that you believe? What exactly is it that you do? Well, which of the 28 fundamentals do you offer, to the famous novelist? So I said, let me go with the Sabbath. Well, I said, we celebrate the Sabbath. It's an oasis in time where we rest from our work. We have time for family, for worship, for refreshment. And she paused. No, I said a bit more than that, you know, but that was the gist of it. And she paused and she said, "How frightfully wonderful." "How frightfully wonderful." Now, you see, I could have said, "Well, let me tell you one thing for certain, famous novelist, Charles Darwin's wrong, and we know it." I don't think she would have given me the same response, because people these days are more interested in what difference does your faith make to your life. I think we should rather start there. The difference that believing that God is our creator makes all the difference to my life, for the following reasons. I think people are more likely then to listen to us, rather than a rationalistic reason of why something else is wrong. Something else might well be wrong, but I don't think people these days are, fewer and fewer people are convinced by that kind of argument.
I can see where Marcel's coming from, because, you know, your experience with this lady, she was a mature thinking lady, but for teenagers growing up in today's society where evolution is the only option, they're not saying, well, this is a theory and also there's this and this. They are only presented with one thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, your answer was right in a way, but I think sometimes we're afraid to say the how. We only answer the why.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as creation is concerned, a lot of people, older people, are saying, oh, well, we must concentrate on the why. Why was God creating the world? And for what reason in respect to us as human beings? So we're afraid of the how, but I think young people, teenagers particularly, want to know the how, and that's a difficult question to answer.
Yes, it is. The pause is an indication of the difficulty. I'm not wishing to pass the buck here, but as a church, we need to be more serious about these matters. Because sometimes what passes for a rebuttal of evolution on closer examination can be just lazy thinking. Something to convince us, but it might not necessarily convince other people. Now, the church has done a fair bit of work on this, but we're not just very good at articulating it. I read a book a little while ago. It was on the issue of creation and evolution. And the author was saying that most arguments put forward against evolution are pseudoscience. They just don't stand up to any investigation, and are many times fraudulent. Then he went on to say, there is, however, one exception to this, and that is the Geoscience Research Institute, operated by the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Hardly anybody outside the Adventist Church is aware of its existence. But in terms of solid scholarship, that is by far the best that there is. When I read that, I was at the one time, you know, a little bit chuffed, you know, to think that that's what somebody would say, but also saddened by the comment that hardly anybody outside the Adventist Church, this person wasn't an Adventist, hardly anybody outside the Adventist Church has heard it. So I think it isn't that we don't have people who can discuss these matters. but we just need to do a better job of it.
In a way, could I answer from my own experience, what Boyle was alluding to there?
There seems to be a movement, I don't know if you've heard about it, called for intelligent design. And these are actually made up from quite prominent scientists, folk like John Lennox, Michael Behe, and you know, folk like that. And to me, they are answering the scientific questions with science. And I think an honest mind would start to say they are actually winning the argument. What they are finding, the objections to them are relying more and more on prejudice and vitriolic attacks to them personally to discredit their scientific qualifications. But I think we are starting to see science answering some of the challenges that these so-called scientists have been raising for many decades.
Yes, I think intelligent design is an interesting development, but it isn't one that we ourselves have got involved in a great deal. We have to some extent, but not to the extent of the people you just referred to, for example, because it's a different kind. It's a different kind of an argument, a different kind of approach to it, and we to some extent are still in a more traditional mode of engaging with it, which is other than this intelligent design.
I know John Walton, who was here earlier today, he gave an excellent talk at one of these intelligent design meetings. I can thoroughly recommend, if anybody has opportunity to attend these, they are extremely good.
Yes,
and they're not Adventists. John obviously is, but the others are not Adventists, but they put forward some very, very sound reasons why they don't accept the evolutionary
intelligent design these days don't believe in the six literal days of creation.
Sadly,
that's what I was referring to, really, because you know, with this dilemma that parents have and children and teachers have, you know, do we accept Genesis 1 literally, six days of creation, or do we believe in intelligent design and God having a sort of power over design, but over a long period of time, millions of years.
In my own experience of dealing, of talking with people, I find that it doesn't help to bring up time scale as the first point in the conversation. I think you need to sort of start elsewhere, and then, you know, move in that direction if you want to. But is that it then?
All right, you've exhausted all the questions.
I've exhausted the speakers.